Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. The global environment, geoengineering, ocean warming, and air pollution in South Asia. France out front on aid to Ukraine. And a ceasefire in Israel. A U.S. proposal was rejected. U.S. ambassadors protest. First, on the global environment, three reports. Can we geoengineer our way out of global warming? It seems that whenever there's a major social issue, scientists and entrepreneurs will search for a technical solution rather than face up to the human causes. So it is with climate change. Geoengineering is gaining in popularity as an alternative to dramatically reducing our carbon-producing lifestyles. The engineering in this instance involves, most simply, several ways to block the sun. The head of a climate nonprofit points to the pitfalls of any such strategy, writing, quote, "The potential risks of solar geoengineering are serious. Spraying reflective particles in one place, for example, could significantly change rainfall patterns elsewhere. What's more, once anyone starts solar geoengineering at a larger scale, suddenly stopping it could lead to termination shock, global temperatures rapidly readjusting to where they would have been without geoengineering. With such terrifying points of no return, every accelerating step of research requires global public participation and deliberation," unquote. Indeed, it does. But more than that, it requires that we citizens and corporations, especially in the richest countries, take responsibility for global warming and not fall for technical fixes whose consequences are unknown. That same writer accepts that argument, but also urges carefully controlled research on the possibilities for geoengineering. That means, he says, quote, "disclosing all funding and effectively managing potential conflicts of interest, ensuring the participation of stakeholders from around the world in decision-making, avoiding groupthink, sharing early-stage results and data to accelerate research, and engaging in radically open science," unquote. All good if those conditions could be met, but experience so far with reaching a global consensus and out-in-the-open research offer grounds for mistrust about what geoengineers might be up to. Second report on ocean warming, which may be out beyond control. Geoengineering may help contain global warming, but the latest pessimistic findings on ocean warming suggest to some scientists that the crisis is beyond control. Following the same pattern as air temperatures, average ocean temperatures are well above previous years. In fact, off the charts and perhaps irreversible, say some scientists. What I reported last week about the situation with the Great Barrier Reef in Australia is just one sign of trouble. A third environmental report is on air pollution, which is killing millions in South Asia. IQ Air, which tracks air pollution worldwide, says in its latest report that 99 of the top 100 most polluted cities in the world are in Asia, with India at 83 heading the list. South Asia is a particular concern, with 29 of the 30 most polluted cities in India, Pakistan, or Bangladesh. The report ranked the major population centers of Lahore in 5th, New Delhi in 6th, and Dhaka in 24th place. Across India, 1.3 billion people, or 96% of the population, live with air quality 7 times higher than World Health Organization guidelines. Perhaps equally disturbing is that of 7,800 cities studied, only 9% met WHO guidelines for healthy air, which means that average annual levels of the dangerous particulate PM2.5 should not exceed 5 micrograms per cubic meter. France out front on aid to Ukraine. French President Emmanuel Macron has been more hawkish than any other European NATO leader in urging maximum aid to Ukraine's resistance. He has insisted that sending troops to Ukraine should not be off the table of options. His reasoning goes like this, quote, "Russia cannot win. If Russia were to win, life for the French would change. We would no longer have security in Europe. Who can seriously believe that Putin, who has respected no limits, would stop there?" Unquote. Therefore, he said the option of sending troops must remain. "I'm right about not being specific," he said. "If war were to spread it to Europe, it would be Russia's sole choice and sole responsibility. But for us to decide today to be weak, to decide today that we would not respond, is being defeated already, and I don't want that." Macron is well ahead of Germany's Olaf Scholz. The two leaders don't see eye to eye on how far to go in support of Ukraine. But they have just recently agreed to joint arms production in Ukraine. One reason Macron may be so determined to defeat Russia. Back in 2022, just before Putin launched his invasion of Ukraine, Macron and Putin had a telephone meeting meant to explore ways to promote dialogue on Ukraine. France has released a video of the phone call. It shows that Putin was lying when he committed to a meeting with Biden and to talks with Ukraine that would include the Russian-supported fighters in eastern Ukraine. Russia's invasion began just a few days after that conversation. I imagine Macron has not forgotten. A ceasefire in Israel. The path to a ceasefire finally produced a United Nations Security Council resolution Monday that calls for an immediate ceasefire coupled with immediate and unconditional release of Israeli hostages. The U.S., to the dismay of Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel, abstained on the resolution. This comes after a U.S. proposal for an immediate and sustained ceasefire in the war was vetoed in the U.N. Security Council by China and Russia. Prior to that vote, the U.S. had cast the lone veto for 3 previous Security Council resolutions calling for a ceasefire. In October, the U.S. had vetoed because the resolution didn't mention Israel's right of self-defense. In December, it vetoed for the same reason, as well as because the resolution called for an immediate, unconditional ceasefire. And in February, the U.S. vetoed a resolution because the ceasefire did not include release of the hostages. Each time, the U.S. had inched closer to where we are now, the call for an immediate ceasefire that becomes part of international law. Meantime, 67 former national security officials, civilian and military, diplomatic and intelligence, wrote to President Biden March 20, urging him to, quote, "make clear to the government of Israel that such practices," referring to denial of civil rights, expansion of settlements, and denial of humanitarian aid, "will be met with serious consequences, including restrictions on provision of assistance consistent with U.S. law and policy," unquote. The letter reiterated what many critics of Israel have been saying for months regarding the, quote, "subjugation of Palestinians following the October 7 Hamas attack." Israel's right to defend itself is not questioned, but the letter's authors cite Israel's indiscriminate killing of civilians in disregard of international law. They also called for an immediate ceasefire, which now has taken effect. In other news, an ambassador takes on Hungary's Orbán. In sharp contrast with Donald Trump's embrace of Viktor Orbán, the Hungarian autocrat and self-styled leader of an illiberal democracy, the U.S. ambassador to Hungary has been close to confrontational with Orbán. In a speech worthy of a pro-democracy activist, Ambassador David Pressman used the occasion of Hungary's 25th anniversary accession to the NATO alliance to remind Hungarians that their country is, quote, "in the club of democracies sworn to protect one another." He quoted Orbán on several occasions in the past, clearly applauding Hungary's ties to the alliance. U.S. soldiers stationed there have been welcomed, and Hungarians and Americans have a long and cherished history of fighting for freedom. But Hungary under Orbán now labels and treats the U.S. as an adversary, says the ambassador, while making policy choices, meaning closer ties to Russia, that increasingly isolate it from friends and allies, unquote. Orbán and his ministers are making unwarranted accusations against the U.S., such as that the U.S. wants to overthrow him. And his government has taken over independent media, taken control of companies owned by party leaders or their families, and silenced judges who are critical of the regime. Pressman acknowledged that a speech like his would not normally be made in an allied country. But working together with Hungary doesn't work, he said. He pointed as examples to Hungary's refusal to close down a Russian bank in Budapest, leading the U.S. to sanction it, and to numerous trips by top Hungarian leaders to Russia since its invasion of Ukraine. Thus, Hungary, rather than being a voice for dealing strongly with Russia, now has to be worked around. Orbán's view that military aid to Ukraine should end and peace talks with Russia should begin does not stand up to reality, he said. The Hungarian policy is based on a fantasy that disarming Ukraine will stop Putin. History shows it would do the reverse, unquote. And Orbán's call for the defeat of President Biden is an unacceptable interference in U.S. affairs, he said. The ambassador concluded that the U.S. wants what Hungarians want, quote, a close relationship between the U.S. and Hungary, rooted in democratic values and shared security and prosperity. Exactly what the prime minister said he wanted 25 years ago, unquote. But it is up to the Hungarian government to demonstrate that it wants to improve relations with the U.S., and, unfortunately, said the ambassador, we see no indication that Hungary wants the same. Putin wins re-election, but not without resistance. Following the urging of Alexei Navalny, Russia's leading dissident who recently died in prison, supporters of a democratic Russia and opponents of Putin's unending rule staged a stand-in at the polls over the March 16 weekend. The protest vote was called Noon Against Putin. Navalny wanted people to wait until noon of the third day of voting to line up, and huge lines appeared, despite a large police presence and some arrests. Putin won the selection, of course, with an astounding 88% of the votes, but a sizable number of Russians showed their disapproval at considerable risk. If people are known by the company they keep, consider which national leaders sent Putin congratulatory notes. Venezuela, Nicaragua, North Korea, China, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Honduras, Cuba, Myanmar, and Bolivia. I wonder, did Donald Trump secretly send one too? Just days after the election, Russia was hit by an attack on a crowded concert hall in a Moscow suburb that killed at least 137 people and injured many more. The attackers, according to U.S. intelligence, belonged to the Islamic State in Khorasan, ISSK, which normally is active in Afghanistan and elsewhere in South Asia. The New York Times reports that, quote, U.S. officials said they had privately alerted Russia earlier this month about intelligence on potential Islamic State activity. The same intelligence prompted a March 7 security alert by the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, warning American citizens of, quote, reports that extremists have imminent plans to target large gatherings in Moscow, to include concerts. Putin said nothing about the U.S. alert, instead accusing Ukraine of facilitating the attack. Ukraine denied any such role. More likely is that the attack is a continuation of the ISK's assault on supporters of the Taliban in Afghanistan. The ISK has attacked Russian, Chinese, and other targets there as part of its campaign to topple the Taliban, which the ISSK considers insufficiently faithful to Sharia law. But the larger significance of this terrorist incident is the contrast between Russia's reign of terror on Ukraine's cities and its vulnerability to terrorist assaults at home. Putin's blaming of Ukraine and the United States is his way of avoiding responsibility for the breakdown of security that allowed the ISSK attack to occur. Finally, China and Vietnam may be headed for a territorial dispute. In previous reports, I've told of escalating tensions between the Philippines and China in the South China Sea. Now we learn that China and Vietnam, another party to competing territorial claims in that area, also have emerging disagreements. In this case, the area is the northern end of the South China Sea, the Gulf of Tonkin, which is bounded by Vietnam on the west, China's Guizhou province to the north, and China's Hainan Island to the east. For decades, Vietnam and China had a common understanding in a fisheries agreement about the line of demarcation separating their territorial waters. But now China has extended its baseline, creeping demarcation it's being called, which amounts to adding to its territorial claim. An Australian expert comments that, quote, this new baseline could complicate earlier agreements and other day-to-day maritime activities and endeavors, such as fishing. He thinks some maritime experts are concerned that the new Chinese baseline might be a violation of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. Quote, if things change from the current demarcation line agreement between the two countries, that might be a worse set of circumstances for Vietnam. You would think Hanoi would need to defend its current entitlements by challenging China's baseline, unquote. At the moment, Vietnam is not saying anything publicly, indicating it is hoping the matter can be settled diplomatically. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to Cable News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. We're turning our attention now to national news. It's well known that former President Donald Trump has used some pretty inflammatory anti-immigrant rhetoric in his public statements, and that has certainly been reported on. But author and activist Max Elbaum says there's much more to the issue than Trump as an individual. He spoke with KABU reporter and KPFA weekend news anchor David Rosenberg.
You don't think that Trump is being taken quite seriously enough, or at least the movement that he represents isn't being taken seriously enough? There's certainly been a lot of publicity about the kind of rhetoric he uses, but you think that the coverage should be deeper than that. What do you mean by that?
Donald Trump as an individual has his own particular quirks and his own particular narcissism and pathology. But the real problem is he has gathered around him forces that are deeply rooted in U.S. life that have a whole history going back in the most recent period to the backlash against the Keynes of the 1960s. And they've coalesced into a social bloc that has a different agenda for the country than the listeners of KPFA radio.
Would you say a different agenda than even the Reagan people or the Bush people or Newt Gingrich, people like that?
Yes. Those people were imperialists and they were conservative. But the Republican Party has been taken over by a bloc that is a direct descendant of the Confederacy in the 19th century, direct descendant of those who opposed racial integration and racial equality in the 1960s. Also a key component of that bloc are the wealthiest right-wing billionaires, the fossil fuel industry, who've never accepted the New Deal, never accepted trade union rights, have been hostile to democracy and majority rule for decades. There's still a belief in U.S. hegemony and are in denial about climate change. So those things have become the dominant force, a coalition of the most right-wing sections of the capitalist class and the layers of the population that are the most invested in racial and gender hierarchies and a theocratic vision of the country. Basically, a white Christian nationalist bloc has taken over the Republican Party. And they're using immigration as their battering ram. It's been since 2015, since Trump announced, immigrants have been a key target of the dehumanization effort to blame the problems of the country and the world on people of color, on people from so-called shithole countries, to use Donald Trump's language, and to scapegoat some of the most vulnerable and marginalized people for the problems that are rooted in the structure of U.S. capitalism.
What are the Democrats doing about that? How are they opposing it, if at all? Biden was on the border along with Trump. He has a different message. Do you think that message is substantially different than what Trump is saying?
Well, on immigration and on foreign policy and Gaza in particular are the biggest differences between progressives and the Biden wing of those who are opposed to the MAGA bloc. So the Biden team on immigration accepts the idea that immigration is a problem and that what we face is a so-called border crisis. The reality is what we're facing is a crisis, a global crisis of the right of people to stay home in safety and security in their countries. And that reason they can't do that has a lot to do with U.S. policies, U.S. policies of war, of exploitation, failure to do something about climate change. And in that respect, the Biden people have adopted an anti-immigrant policy, a misdiagnosis of the problem, or I would even say a cover-up of the U.S. role in this problem. And in that respect, it's not much different from Donald Trump and the MAGA bloc. And it has to be completely opposed by the progressive movement, just as Biden's policies around Israel-Palestine have to be opposed with as much energy and sophistication as we can muster.
The Biden people might say, well, look, we have to get something done. We had to compromise. We had to do something about immigration in order to get our funding for Ukraine and Israel passed. So that's what we had to do in practical political terms. How would you respond to that?
I would say that they say that's what they have to do, but they're speaking for a particular class interest when they say we. That isn't the interest that we have as progressive people who are interested in what's best for the majority of people in this country and the majority of people around the world. There is a problem of people being unable to stay home in safety, and the way that the United States should deal with it has to do with changing its foreign policy and adhering to international law on the right of people who are migrating to seek asylum if they're unsafe in their home countries. That kind of message, over time, we have to fight for that kind of message, because that kind of message is an integral part, is connected to the fight against authoritarian rule and the kind of fascism that U.S.-style fascism that the MAGA bloc represents. There's plenty of things that can be done about the immediate problems of the large numbers of people trying to reach the United States. Those things can be done in a way that benefits the working class and does not demonize the most marginal. Closing detention centers, distributing the funds that will process people who are seeking asylum, adhering to international law about the right of asylum, changing U.S. foreign policy so not as many people are forced to leave their homes, granting a route to legalization and full political rights to those people who are here and have been contributing to the U.S. economy. And we have to fight around that, not just on humanitarian grounds, but on the grounds that, as New York Times article showed, immigration is a positive contributor to the growth of the U.S. economy and a positive contributor to U.S. Culture and the links between people in the United States and around the globe. And especially, we do have to reject, and in this, the Democrats are somewhat different from the Republicans, the whole racist demonization and dehumanization of immigrants that's being used as the last article I wrote in Convergence was called First They Came for the Immigrants. People think that the dehumanization of immigrants that's being spawned by the rhetoric of the MAGA bloc is going to stop with immigrants. They're kidding themselves. The whole discussion that the country is being invaded by vermin, infecting the body politic, this is the kind of traditional language of fascism that can be imposed against any group of people. So the defense of immigrants right now is a key part of the defense of democracy. And we have to pressure the Biden administration, just as people in Michigan the other day were pressuring the Biden administration around Gaza by voting uncommitted in the Democratic primary, showing that they reject MAGA and they're not interested in voting for Trump. But they want to make the case that the Biden administration is losing key parts of its potential voting base, those who want to vote against MAGA but are disgusted by Biden administration's policies, particularly around immigration and Gaza.
Do you think the connection between the crime and the terrible conditions that exist in other countries that cause people to come here is not being connected to U.S. foreign policy that you mentioned? Do you think the media here doesn't really cover that at all?
Occasionally it's mentioned, but it's not given its due. And it's also true, the United States government is not the only bad actor in the world. You can't blame every single thing and every problem completely on the U.S. government. If you look at what's going on in Myanmar right now and in various other places in the world. So it's certainly not an exclusive U.S. problem, but the U.S. remains the dominant world power. It has a key role in the structure of the world economy. The U.S., more than any other country, still shapes that. The U.S. government still shapes, more than any other country, the way weapons are spreading all over the world, the role of violence, militarization of problems. Again, the U.S. isn't the only problematic actor in the world, but it has a huge influence on that. And were the U.S. to shift policy, it wouldn't solve every problem in the world immediately, but it would make a huge difference in people's lives all over Latin America, Africa, Asia, the Middle East, as well as in North America and here in the United States.
Anything else you want to add to what you said?
We're in a very dangerous political time. There's been a 60-year backlash against the gains of the 1960s. That's attacked every progressive gain going back to the New Deal. Make America Great Again wants to take the country back to the 19th century, the era of Jim Crow, the Gilded Age, all wealth to the wealthy, turn over fossil fuels, turn over the energy policy to the fossil fuel industry. They've built up a big apparatus, and they now control the Republican Party, the Supreme Court, and they're already implementing their agenda in the 20-some states where they have where the Republican Party has trifectas. But we can't fight that solely through talking about the dangers of MAGA and only talking about issues where there is a clear difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, like abortion, LGBTQ rights, labor rights, and the difference between a Biden NLRB and what a Trump NLRB would be. We have to also fight for progressive change across the board and for a positive vision of where we're going. And immigration has got to be a key part of that. Defense of immigrants is an injury to one and injury to all. And right now, in this primary season and in the season before the general election, the contention between progressives and the Democratic Party leadership comes to the fore, and we have to demonstrate, we have to propagandize, and we have to defend the squad who are under attack by anti-progressives. There's a whole bunch of things we have to do so that progressives gain influence and we can shape the direction of the country in the long term.
That was author and activist Max Elbaum speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. Elbaum writes for Convergence magazine. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
To KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
KBOO just finished our All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. We want to thank all of our